Maritime Matters, global perspectives through a German lens for the maritime industry. We bring the German perspective to the world and global insights to Germany. Maritime Matters is produced by the German Maritime Center, the think tank for the German maritime sector.
Welcome to our podcast. My name is Matthias Katon. I'm the managing director of the German Maritime Center and your host. Today we talk about decarbonization in the maritime world, about green fuels, energy efficiency, and other topics related to that. And my guest for this session is Jason Stefanatos. He is the Global Decarbonization Director at DNV Maritime, which is, as most of us will know, one of the world's leading classification societies and maritime advisors. He has spent the past 15 years there with DNV, working in both Greece and Norway across research advisory and business development roles. Jason is a naval architect by training, and he holds a degree in naval architecture and marine engineering from the National Technical University of Athens. In his current role, he works closely with ship owners around the world on some of the biggest issues and questions facing the industry today, which is how to comply with new environmental regulations, how to adopt cleaner fuels, how to make ships more energy efficient, and how to manage emissions in a rapidly changing landscape. In short, if you're a ship owner trying to figure out how to decarbonize your fleet, Jason is one of the people you would call. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the nice introduction and very happy to be here.
Jason, as I said, you have spent the past 15 years at DNV in different roles in both Greece and Norway. Can you tell our listeners what your role involves day to day? What kind of decisions do you help ship owners take?
Yeah, this is a quite broad range. My role is to have the overview of decarbonization activities for DNV. And this entails many things. What I am doing is I talk to all the stakeholders of the industry, ship owners, shipyards, vendors, cargo owners, trying to understand what they do, what they need. And I make sure that the DNV direction is going that way and that we are acting in a way that we can help the industry go forward in the decarbonization journey.
DNV is one of the largest classification societies in the world, and you have a kind of a bird's eye view, I would say, about what's going on in the shipping industry. From that vantage point, what would you say, where does shipping stand in 2026 when it comes to decarbonization?
I think it's safe to say that we're quite well. We have done quite a lot of effort. You know, when it comes to decarbonization, there are many ways to approach it and see what has been done. It's very easy to point fingers and throw the dark emissions above the funnel of a vessel. But reality is that the industry has been taking steps for quite a few years, even decades up to a point. We have been improving the fleet. If you compare vessels of today with vessels of 10, 15, 20 years ago, there is no comparison in how much fuel they consume or how much emissions they emit. There has been a very big adoption of alternative fuels, spearheaded by LNG, and all the fuels have been tested, piloted, even built and operated. And we have been doing quite a lot of work. There is also a misconception by a few that decarbonization will happen overnight or within 2 years, which is not the case. Whoever has done any work around new technologies or new fuels especially, we know that it will take some time and it will be a stepwise approach that will need many stakeholders to work together. So currently, most of the regulation is focusing on the ship owners and they are the ones that get the compliance pressure to do things. If we check the numbers, they have done what they need. If you check, for example, alternative fuels, by 2030, the global fleet will be able to burn, will have the theoretical capacity of burning 50 million tons of equivalent fuel, which is quite high compared to the total amount of fuel we consume in the global fleet, which is 280 million tons. So the steps have been taken, the fleet is being prepared, but we need to make sure that the other stakeholders are active as well. So fuel producers, cargo owners, they are also need to do their part. When it comes to cargo owners, they are also very active. We have seen many cargo owners the past years and decades pushing for greener solutions, for new fuels, for testing things. So coming back to responding to the question at hand, I think we are on a quite good track.
You rightly said it's not going to happen overnight, but I understand you correctly that you're seeing that there is still progress being made, because some people would also argue that we've come to a standstill in a certain way, or some people might even argue that we're moving backwards. But your feeling from DNV's point of view is that we're still even slowly moving into the right direction.
Exactly. And it depends also the time period when you analyze the deltas. If you check the past 3 months, yes, there is something that could be interpreted as a slowdown. But if you see the big picture, if we take again the fuel orders, the past between April and October, there were very few orders. So many ship owners that were waiting for the signal from IMO. And this signal did not come. So there was no clarity delivered. That means that the ship owners that were going for conventional fuels still will go for conventional fuels. It does not mean that we had a decrease, but it was what it was before. We still have the same drivers. We still have the drivers that there were there before the IMO meetings. And in that sense, when we see the entire period and we have a time frame of 30, 50, 60 years to decarbonize the industry, I think we are proceeding as planned, with the ups and downs. Of course, the wider geopolitical framework will also affect how shipping is moving. If we have other issues to solve, some issues may take a second priority, but the ambition and the drive is there. And I think on the long term, we are doing a good job as an industry.
Let's talk about regulation for a moment, because you just mentioned it. There are different levels of regulation. There's regulations on the European level. For example, the requirement that ships calling at EU ports must gradually reduce greenhouse gas intensity of their fuels. And then, of course, there are global rules that are being developed, or supposedly being developed, one should maybe say, by the IMO, the International Maritime Organization. For those of our listeners who are not in the nitty-gritty of those levels and regulations, could you give us a plain language overview of what kind of rule sets exist, what is coming, how does this regulatory landscape evolve globally?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are many ways to approach it. If we take, let's start by the regulations in place that actually affect us already today. We have two main bodies that enforce regulations on emissions. One is the IMO, the International Maritime Organization, and the other is the EU. The EU has been establishing the MRV, the Monitoring, Reporting and Verification Scheme, back in 2017, to start understanding what is the size of the emissions from the fleet, but only focused on the European-related operations. IMO followed 1 year later with a global scheme, trying to monitor the entire global fleet. A few years later, EU took the next step, which is to add the monetary incentive on this. It added the ETS, the Emission Trading Scheme, and the FuelEU. These are two schemes that, in a nutshell and in very layman's terms, we, based on how much emissions we monitor from the MRV, these are connected with some costs. In the case of ETS, it is based on the amount of CO2 that is being emitted, so it is a cost for each ton of CO2 emitted, while in FuelEU, it has a different take. It focuses on the type of fuel that is being burnt on board. So it's not directly counting the amount of emissions, but mainly what type of fuel the vessels are burning. Both are connected with some cost in case you don't achieve compliance. This was a reality, and is still a reality, is something that has been rolled out 2 years ago and last year, ETS and FuelEU respectively, and has been pushing the industry. We can say that both schemes, the cost level is at such a point that is not really pushing the investments today. It is an extra effort and an extra burden that the ship owners need to handle and the cargo owners. But the level of the exposure of the cost is at such stage that it can be passed along the value chain. The concept of these schemes is that as we go forward, there will be more and more increase on the compliance, and that will increase the cost, so it will push the ship owners and cargo owners towards more new technologies and greener solutions. Now, on the other side, we have a similar step that the IMO is planning to take. This took the form of the so-called Net Zero Framework. It was a framework to have global application brought mainly on the table last April 2025 from IMO. It was put on the table to be approved and finalized in last October. Last October, there was something that most of the industry was not expecting, that this decision was not taken to finalize and approve it, and the decision was delayed for 1 year. So now we're at the stage that there are many stakeholders in the industry with different opinions. There are two main, let's say, camps or opinions. People that want to see the net zero framework going forward and think that this will have an impact on reducing the emissions. And there are other stakeholders that are against it and try to find alternatives. It's very hard to predict what will happen. From the DNV side, what we can do, and being unbiased, the technical advisors of the industry, is that we need to analyze the facts and see what needs to be done and what can be done, and make sure that we have a global framework that, first of all, has consensus of the industry. This is a prerequisite. Even if you have a marginal approval of one framework, it may create issues in the future. So we need to make sure that we have one global framework that captures the industry. And also, coming back to the ETS and the fuel EU now, we've seen a lot of ship owners with high exposure in the EU considering their decarbonization plans for the most economical effective compliance. Today, we see mainly going for energy efficiency and to reduce consumption affecting the ETS, and biofuels for pooling. So my point is that we still have EU ETS and fuel EU, and owners need to comply. And still, the people that had plans, they continue to follow them for these two schemes.
Yeah. I mean, you gave a very diplomatic answer when it comes to what happened at the IMO. I think what is fair to say is that, of course, there was pushback from the US administration, helped by a few other mainly carbon fuel producing countries, who, for obvious reasons, I guess, had not a big incentive to move forward. Now, officially, it's been postponed. So I think this fall, the topic will be discussed again. Now, the question is, of course, will the political landscape have changed? And I personally don't see it. So the question is, how likely is it that the net zero framework will pass in the fall? You mentioned that, of course, the EU system is still in place. Other countries are also, I believe, working on their own trade emission systems. Is there a risk that we will have global fragmentation where, you know, instead of one global set of rules, we'll have 5, 10, 15, whatever, which will obviously make things extremely bureaucratic for ship owners who, by definition, most of them at least, move across the globe and may have to comply not with one trading system, but with maybe half a dozen or so?
Exactly. This is what we also see as the main risk of not achieving consensus at IMO level for a global framework. We expect that there will be indeed fragmentation. We know that many regions and countries have expressed interest in the past years to have some local scheme. The challenges here are multifold. Exactly as you said, that it will add complexity. It will add more schemes that will not be unified. So for international trading companies and vessels, it will be an extra burden to keep all the various compliance requirements at hand. But also, we see a bigger threat that if we have regional schemes, the impact of these schemes may be less. One is because you will not have the global trade. There is a counter argument there that if you have a few regions that are dominant when it comes to marine traffic, then you still can have impact. So let's say that you have Australia, China, and Canada and Brazil having schemes, adding on top of the EU, then you have schemes, you will have schemes in most of the traffic, so it will potentially, it could have an impact. But the other risk is that there is some expectation that some of these schemes will be just money collecting schemes, the regional ones. You know, so the cost that will be paid by the ship owners towards those schemes will just be siphoned to other usages by the regions owning the schemes. This is why I also stress that when we talk about a global framework, it creates a global playing field for all to understand. We need to be easy to understand and how to comply, but it also needs to be rewarding and make sure that all the funds that are being raised or under whatever scheme we end up having are going back to shipping. We need to make sure that we use this effort to improve the fleet, to reduce emissions, and make sure that we achieve our targets to practically decarbonize shipping or reduce emissions in shipping.
We're both from EU countries, we're both Europeans, and often it is said that while Europe is weak militarily, for example, we have this regulatory superpower because, you know, we have strong regulations in many areas. And often what happens, because also the EU internal market is so big, other countries fall in line and they follow the regulatory model or the regulatory framework of the EU. Is that also something that you see possible in this field, or is this fragmentation of different systems actually unavoidable?
Yeah, that is a very good question. I have to make a disclaimer. My master was on marine engineering, not political sciences, so I will do my best to give a response. Indeed, at least if we focus on the decarbonization and the emissions regulations, indeed, EU has been quite active and takes the first step. But I have to say that it's not only EU. I mean, at IMO level, we have been working with emissions regulations the past 20 years or even more, right? I mean, 20 years is the peak season, the high activity when we also have regulations rolling out. I think since the problem is there and we have identified it, we need to make sure that we take all the steps. And there may be a debate of what measure is actually impactful or not, but at the end, we need to take steps. And at the same time, we need to be pragmatic, so we cannot disrupt the industry to fix one thing and produce other problems. But I feel, from my role, I go around the globe talking to many stakeholders. I think it's safe to say that it's not only the EU that is quite active and wants to be active and regulatory. Also, if we go towards the East and the Far East, we also see a very big drive towards similar schemes.
Nautical numbers.
It's one of our fixed segments in this podcast, and we always ask our guests to bring one number that belongs or pertains to the session's topic. So, Jason, what is your nautical number?
I mean, I'm among two numbers. I can start with one, and if you allow me, I can maybe use the second one.
Sure, we'll give you a bonus number, second number.
Thank you. I would say the one number that comes in mind is 90. And this 90 is 90%, which is, or if you want to read the 10%, 10% is the percentage of the existing fleet that is able to burn alternative fuels. So 10%, depending on how you see the glass, half empty or half full, you can say that 10% is a very big number of vessels to burn alternative fuels today, considering when we started this effort. But also in the same sentence, you can say it's still 90% that burns conventional fuel. So this is the, I consider that one number, that is important to show that we have started, we are doing very good job, as we said in the beginning, but we still have a very long way to go. And this is something we need to keep in mind across the entire range of discussion, either being a technical or a regulatory or a future discussion of where we stand.
Very good point. Of course, I understand that this number refers to the entire fleet. So there are some new ships, but there are also some very old ships. I believe seagoing vessels have an average lifespan of about 30 years. Some of the internal waterways ships are considerably older. We know that here in Germany, we have ships that are go up and down the Rhine that are 70 years old or even older. So that is, of course, a number that is being influenced by a significant proportion of older ships. Now, if we look at the order book, and you have a very good overview of what's happening there as well as a classification society, I believe, and I think this data is also from DNV, is that around 40% of newly built ships are now able to run on alternative fuels, and I think LNG is still at the top there, but methanol also is following. Give us an overview. When we talk about alternative fuels, what types of technologies are there and how dominant or how much used are they actually today in ships that are either already operating or being built right now?
I think the number is exactly as you said, it's 40-42%. A few months ago, it used to be a bit higher. This has dropped for many reasons, but the two main ones is that, as I said earlier, we had a large amount of vessels that the owners were waiting to order until they see some clarity from IMO, and then they all got ordered within the last 2 months of 2025 and the first month of 2026. But also it's connected that when you see this number, it's not uniform. We don't see 40% across all ship types and ship segments. You see container ships, car carriers and crews, they are leading. They have more than 70-80% uptake when it comes based on GT. When we go to bulkers and tankers, we see significantly less uptake. And this makes sense. You know, we don't expect all the vessels to start using new fuels. It has to do with the trade being liner or spot. It has to do with the size, the cargo they transport. Container ships and car carriers, for example, the cargo they carry is much closer to the end user. So if the end user is willing to pay for some net zero transport, the cargo owner can pass this cost along the value chain. So my first point is that we see a lot of uptake, but it is not uniform across the industry. So we understand the uptake per fuel. LNG is the most mature among all the fuels. I mean, the main fuels that we discuss is LNG, methanol / ethanol, ammonia, and hydrogen. So LNG is by far the most mature technology. We have LNG carriers burning LNG for decades. We have non-LNG carriers burning LNG for years. We have more than 1,300 non-LNG carrier vessels that are able or will be able to burn LNG. And we also have good infrastructure. There is high cost, so you need to justify why you go to LNG. You need to have someone to pay for that cost. But beyond that, it is a solution that is being adopted. There is also the challenge that LNG is fossil. So when we talk about the LNG pathway, we need to make sure that we also open the green LNG option in the future. Now, when it comes to methanol, first of all, let me start by saying that methanol is not a new fuel. The first methanol-fueled tanker was delivered in 2016. DNVGL class back then. So we have experience. There were 30 tankers built and operated since then. But then it lost some interest. It won it again when some big container ship operators and players went for methanol. Then it lost a bit again. Now it's up again. We had bulk carriers going for methanol. I think methanol is on a track to become more and more mature. There are many pros with methanol that it is not much, but it is lower capex and easier operations, less challenges on board. The barriers we see with methanol is infrastructure, availability, and energy cost, especially for the green version of the fuel. So this is what we see with methanol being the main barriers. When it comes to ammonia, this is at a much earlier stage of development. Now, this year, we expect the first engines to be delivered on actual vessels and run on ammonia. And we are still at what I call the knowledge collecting period. So it's not that we expect ammonia to scale up next year just because we will have the first engines. We are still working on identifying all the challenges. We have worked with Fortescue and Singapore Flag to make the first ammonia-fueled vessel. It was a retrofit of an offshore supply vessel. We got first-hand on what does it mean to have an ammonia-fueled vessel. And we understand the risks, we understand the challenges, and that we have some more way to go until we reach high uptake. Again here, apart from the technical challenges that will be solved one way or the other, we have the main barriers being high capex, but again, infrastructure and energy cost, like with methanol. An interesting element here is that when we talk about availability of fuels in the future, we need to take one step back and see the big picture. It's not only shipping that is decarbonizing or aiming for reduced emissions for net zero. All the industries have similar ambitions and targets, maybe with different speeds, with different requirements, but all are going there. So we also need to see the big picture of what fuels are going to be available for the land industry that can also be used for shipping. And ammonia is among these, as with hydrogen. So hydrogen is a clean solution, can be a clean solution. There are many countries that have targets to go to hydrogen-based economies. China is one of these countries, and it is such a big economy that can impact other regions and shipping as well. When it comes to the uptake of hydrogen in shipping, technically, it is quite low. We don't expect hydrogen to be used as main fuel for ocean-going vessels, at least anytime soon. But we see many applications in smaller vessels, in ferries, in other vessels that have smaller requirements in terms of range, and also as auxiliary power in fuel cells, even in cruise ships.
So it seems to me that it's a bit like the fashion, right? Colors change, and also the popularity of alternative fuels changes quite rapidly. And I've only been in the sector actually for about a year and a half since I joined the German Maritime Center. And even there, as you said, you know, methanol was very popular at the time. It has now fallen out of fashion a little bit. Ammonia, as you said, some people really seem to love it. Others say it's absolutely no possibility, mainly because of security or safety concerns. I've even heard people now starting to push nuclear propulsion for civilian purposes, which I think for many reasons is even, you know, further down the line and even more controversial than ammonia. Does that create part of this chicken and egg problem? You mentioned earlier that, of course, it's not just ship owners who need to play a role, also port operators, for example, who have to provide the infrastructure. But they're also, I guess, waiting to see which type of fuel takes the lead before they invest in costly infrastructure. And it may also not be possible to have five different fuel types at every significant port, I suppose.
Yeah. We also see this race. I like to also frame it in a different way. It's not a race among the fuels. We are such early in this journey that we need to have all the pathways open. It's very early to just shut down solutions today. And this is why I see all the fuels not competing to each other, but working in parallel to make sure that we have all the options, or at least more options, in our future, which is going to be challenging. In that sense, I don't think the majority of the industry thinks like that. You have, of course, stakeholders that have interest in one versus the other fuel. So, of course, they will push against or in favor of one fuel or the other, or against the other. But from our role, we need to stick to the facts. We need to analyze the pros and cons, the challenges and the benefits of each fuel, and make sure that we try to tackle the challenges and gain from the benefits. This is the only way forward. But having said that, it's still the energy game. It's not something that we will decide based on pure technical considerations. We need again to see the bigger geopolitical frame. We need to see how the energy balance is on all the industries. Let's not forget that industries, the shipping industry, has 3% of the global energy mix. So it is not a consumer of energy that can shift the way we go for the global energy production. Definitely, we can shift the direction when it comes to marine fuels. We can have direction that we also impact. But it is up to the energy producers and distributors mainly.
Yeah, and I think one issue is also that depending on the type of fuel and the overall demand globally is that the marine sector may be priced out of some of the fuel types, especially if there are other industries, aviation and others, who may be able or willing to pay more for a specific type of alternative fuel.
Exactly. Biofuels is a very good example. I mean, now I mentioned earlier that the most popular compliance option for fuel EU are biofuels, liquid biofuels. So owners burn biofuels in one or more vessels and they pull all the rest and they are compliant, which is a perfect and very good solution. But the challenge here is that this may not be like that in the future. Because today you can find small quantities of biofuels, but still, if you see the numbers, shipping uses 0.6% of the global biofuel supply. The aviation is using 0.5. That means something more than 1%. The rest, 99%, is used by road. And if road industry is eager to pay more, they will get the lion's share. So now in the future, we expect electrification of the road transport to reduce the demand on fuels and therefore biofuels. But also aviation needs to decarbonize. So the biofuels that may be available from the less demand of road, assumingly, will be consumed by aviation. So the risk that you pose is very true, that we may be left out of some of the options just because of the cost.
Now, in essence, nobody really knows what's going to happen. It's a bit of a chicken and egg problem affected by technology, by regulation, by geopolitics, by the global economy as a whole. How do ship owners deal with that? And I think there's even a term for that that's called fuel optionality. How can ship owners hedge their bets when they invest in essentially very expensive and long-term assets such as new ships?
Well, this is the not million, billion dollar question. And this is where every owner is struggling. First of all, let's see why it is there. Decision making in shipping was always hard. It was not easy. You know, it's not a very straightforward industry. You need to be out of the box thinking and do a lot of things to be competitive. But the past years, the complexity of the decision making has gone over the roof. And the main reason is lack of clarity. We have lack of clarity when it comes to regulation, when it comes to the fuels availability, to the costs, to technology availability. All these have created such an uncertainty that it's very hard to take easy decisions. My personal view is that I don't expect this to go away anytime soon. So even if we normalize a bit more and we have clarity from IMO or from other schemes, wherever they come from, still the complexity will be there because we will be at a different level. And in this respect, what we see today and what we suggest is that the ship owners should go for as much flexibility as they can afford. It's very simple, but it is effective. I mean, when you have uncertainty, the wider you can be diversified, the best position you will have in the future. We see many owners that they go with one single idea in front. It is a bet. You take a bet with bigger or smaller stakes. The wider the flexibility of the vessel, the better is to be there.
But I assume also the higher the cost, one could probably say, because it's probably more expensive to have an engine that can burn different types of fuel than having one that only burns one.
Exactly. And this is why I said it's an exercise of balance between the cost and the potential attractiveness in the future.
So we're unfortunately not able to answer the billion-dollar question on this podcast. I had hoped that you would give it out, but apparently not. So
you know, my
maybe that's for your paid consulting with with the industry.
That is a good point. I can also say one more thing that takes one step forward on that. You know, it's very typical that the decisions are taken based on gut feeling. But this is a time that is very critical to take the decisions based on facts. We have very few facts, but if you can also have some good assumptions combining these few facts, then you can do. And this is why I always suggest to the ship owners to take the study, to do the study. Let's take an example. If you are to order a new vessel and you know that this ship type and size does not go for alternative fuels, you go for conventional, still make the exercise, because the conditions can change so dramatically that in 1 or 2 years it may make sense. And this is where uncertainty kicks in, that when you have uncertainty you need knowledge, and the more you test, the more you learn, the more you study, the more knowledge you get, the less assumptions you have and the more facts you have. So this is one step more beyond just being flexible.
Navigators Table.
Every episode, we ask our guests to bring a recommendation for a restaurant, a bar, something that has a connection to the maritime world. Jason, what do you recommend to our listeners? Where should they go?
Yeah, that is very interesting. Well, I thinking out of the box. I use that phrase many times today, so I will do it myself. I would say eat wherever people fry things. And I can justify it, because we talked about biofuels and we talked about sustainable biomass, about having sustainable feedstock to produce sustainable biofuels. And one way to do it is to use residual cooking oil. And this is something that is fueling most of our vessels now. There are companies that collect used cooking oil and process it in order to create sustainable biofuels that can solve the other problem. So if I had to pick one restaurant, would be something that fries things.
Good. I'm not sure this will go down very well with health professionals, but still, I mean, fried food is at least tasty. So Jason recommends eat more fried food. That will help the industry because the cooking oil can be recycled for ships. That is an interesting take on alternative fuels as well. I hadn't thought of it that way. Now, we've talked a lot about alternative fuels, but of course there is other ways that ship owners can increase the efficiency of their vessels. Can you maybe give us an overview of what kind of the main things are that you are working on with your clients right now?
Yeah, energy efficiency is something that has always been on the top of the agenda of ship owners. It's not something new. We have been working for decades. Technical departments of ship owners have long experience of assessing and implementing and using technology. And the driver, of course, has always been that it reduces consumption and therefore reduces the costs, and today also reduces emissions and emissions costs. The difference we see now is that we are going through a golden decade of innovation in energy efficiency. We have an abundance of development. This is good because we have more solutions, but also creates a risk. Creates the risk that we may have challenges to actually accurately verify savings. When we have new technologies, we are not mature to understand if they actually work or not. We see claims that can be exaggerating sometimes, and this is where we have been working also as DNV the past years to develop science-based, data-based methodologies to assess the technology. And this is where we always try to help the industry and the ship owners test the technology, make sure you have science-based, scientific methodologies to understand the technology, and then you can see if you can scale it up. When it comes to which technologies are more used, I think hydrodynamic solutions are the most popular ones because they are easy to implement. They have been, it's easy to verify the savings, and they have quite good returns on investment. We also have machinery improvements, but also we see more and more interest in bigger and more exotic solutions. And the best example is wind-assisted propulsion systems. We have seen a very big rise of interest. I can remember myself 15 years ago talking about wind sails to a group of technical owners, and they were almost laughing about the idea. And today it is a reality. Another disclaimer is that it's not for everyone, right? It's not, and this goes for all the technology, the new technology. It does not mean that we will have 100% uptake of the fleet. But where it makes sense, it really makes sense and can have a good impact. And it is a matter of using the technology, getting more knowledge, and then finding new ways of operation, reducing the capex, and also finding even new business models of how this could be used. One example when it comes to wind, to counter the big capex and also the challenge that it is very route-specific savings that you can have. You need to have a route that has favorable winds to get savings. I know that a few vendors are working on a solution. Plus, the third element is that it's very easy to prepare the vessel to be wind ready. So you make all the foundations and the changes, and you can retrofit the wind sail in less than 2 days alongside. You don't even need to go to dry dock. So if you combine all these three, we see vendors working on solutions that you can have your vessel ready to take a sail. It does not have the sail installed, so it's not, the owner has not paid for the investment. But then when you shift and you have a route that you know for the next 6 months will be on favorable winds like the North Atlantic, then you retrofit the sail, you use it for these 6 months, and then you take it out, it can go to another vessel. Solutions like that need to be investigated. You know, as I said earlier, we are at a stage of the decarbonization journey that we need to explore everything. We need to leave no stone unturned in order to identify what can we do and how can we achieve our goals to reduce emissions.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, but there's also a lot of innovation. Of course, we recently at another event, we talked about these systems, and there's, of course, the sails, but there's also the flattener rotors installed in a fixed way on a ship. I also think they experiments with certain types of coatings, I believe, that somehow enhance energy efficiency. Propellers, of course, different types of propellers. That was probably what you referred earlier to, right, with hydro efficiency. Okay, so you would say there is no one solution where you say outside of alternative fuels is kind of the solution that yields the most results, globally speaking?
No, I would say it depends on the ship type and size. It's similar to the fuels, right? It's not for every vessel.
Jason, we've already actually come to the end of this episode. We understand that it's all very much in flux, as of course we knew before. We need to rely on data that is solid and is also impartial. I guess that is one of the roles that DNV and other classification societies play in this world. So thank you very much for taking the time to being a guest here on this show today.
Thank you very much for a very live and vibrant discussion as well. My pleasure to be here.
Likewise. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you learned something new. If you like the show, please leave us a review and a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. And don't forget to check out the show notes and more information about the German Maritime Center at maritimematters.de.